Okay. Thank you, Antoine, for the introduction. This basically is a tale of work that has been done at a company called Ontario Power Generation, which you may know in this province. So this spans about 5 to 6 years. This basically is focused on modeling wind energy. Initially, when the first modeling exercise started, there was hardly any wind energy in the province. So the question was, what's going to happen when we've got a couple of thousand megawatts wind installed? How's this going to affect price? How's this going to affect dispatch, et cetera, et cetera? This is more from a strategic point of view. Models were developed and implemented, and this gave some insight in what would happen. And since then, we've progressed to short-term. We used similar techniques to forecast what's going to happen over the next day, 2 days, 3 days in terms of wind energy, and that has operational consequences because that dictates how units and generators are going to be dispatched. I'm not just going to talk about wind energy. To really understand the impact that wind energy has on the system, you need to know a little bit about electricity and the price process, how that comes about. Without it, you won't understand why wind is important and some of its characteristics. Let me say I'm very pleased to be asked to speak here, and I'm more than pleased to have Bill Smith as my second presenter. He's from Siemens, and he's one of the most knowledgeable guys in the business, so I think I sort of engineered this just to make sure that he'd be here so that I can ask him some questions on my models afterwards, see how good my models reflect reality. So. Okay, let's move forward. Okay, first of all, let's talk about the installed wind capacity in the province. This is a snapshot of May this year. In May, there's about 1,400 megawatts installed capacity, and we've got roughly the same at the moment, about 1,450, 1,500 megawatts. As you can see from this table, there's still about 500 to 600 megawatts under development. This will come online over the next year. And there's still potential for a lot more. The Green Energy Act and the contract with Samson could add about 3,000 to 4,000 megawatts of wind. So it would not be inconceivable that in, say, 5 to 7 years, we have 5,000 to 7,000 megawatts of wind in the province. And that is an enormous amount of wind. Okay. If you look at the distribution of wind, wind farms, yes. But you got to compare it to the installed capacity. If you look at a nuclear unit, a reasonable size nuclear unit is about 500, 550 megawatts. So this is equivalent to about 10 to 15 nuclear units. If you look at the distribution of wind farms over the province, way up in the northwest, we've got Prince Wind Farm. We've got all these wind farms. We've got one wind farm just in the middle here, a couple here, and a couple there. You may ask, why are those wind farms exactly in those positions? I've superimposed a heat map. This is the province of Ontario. The wind potential is colored. So the darker the color, the higher the wind potential is. So these dark purple regions have wind speeds, annual wind speeds, in excess of 9 to 10 meters per second, which is fairly high. You can see that inland there's hardly any potential for wind. And if we really wanted to go further, we can go up way up north. And these are, you get fairly high wind speeds there. The problem is nobody lives there, of course. Same thing if you go north here. But if you map these dark colored regions onto the province, you see exactly this corresponds to a high density region. The only one that's sort of anomalous is Amaranth in the middle of that island. Okay. I'll refer back to this wind atlas at some point. Okay. But you can see we have basically four pockets of wind here, 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 and there. It is important if you've got 5,000 megawatts of wind concentrated in one single location, I mean, this increases your risk quite drastically. If the wind doesn't blow, you have zero. If the wind blows strongly, you have 5,000 megawatts of wind. So there's some benefit of geographical diversification on the province. Okay? point that I want to make on this, if we would have like 5,000 to 7,000 megawatts of wind installed in a couple of years from now, you'll see, hopefully at the end of the presentation, you'll recognize that if we cannot predict the wind accurately to the tune of 5,000 to 7,000 megawatts of wind, nothing else matters. Okay? So hopefully at the end of the presentation, that is a message that I got across. Okay, let's move on. So why does wind matter? Wind is must run under the current rules, and because of that, it displaces other generation. So every megawatt of wind that is running means some other generator does not run. So it has revenue consequences for other operators in the market. The second point is currently coal is being phased out in Ontario and is being replaced by green energy. Now what this means is that we had about 4,000 to 6,000 megawatts of coal in the province. This provides a buffer between baseload generation, which is nuclear, and higher priced generation, which used to be gas-fired generators. Now, it means if load varies, you're in this whole range of coal. It means that if load goes up and down, it doesn't matter that much. You still have a fairly stable price process. With coal being taken out, it doesn't take that much to go from base load, which is nuclear generation, to higher priced generators. And this increases the volatility of price of electricity. Okay. Then the last point is the Green Energy Act, the GEA, and its FIT program, that's the feed-in tariff program. It has and will dramatically increase the share of renewables in the province. And most of this is wind energy. So this is important. Now, like I said, we have about 1,400 megawatts of wind. Any opportunities or problems we have currently with 1,400 will only be exaggerated when we go to 5,000 megawatts of wind. So. Okay, so because of this, we need to be able to forecast wind, and fairly accurately. Okay. Now, forecasting goes in a couple of different buckets. The first one is long-term wind energy forecasting. This is important from a system planning perspective. Suppose you plan for the next 10, 15, 20 years. You want to have a diversified portfolio of generators. You want to figure out how much wind can the system bear, where should it be located, and how much am I willing to pay for it. Like the aspect of a diversified wind portfolio, initially, once the first wind farms, they basically offered their, like the first developers offered this to the different provinces, say we can give you a wind farm at this and this capacity, and they were all taken. And now some jurisdictions, particularly I know of New England, they're actually looking at system planning on this. They have installed wind capacity. And they're looking at, okay, there's somebody offering us a wind farm of 100 megawatts. Now, where should this be located? It may be that it's better to locate a wind farm, say, higher up in the province or a different part of the province where you don't have that much installed wind capacity to diversify. So they're looking at, rather than just taking whatever the wind developers give them, being reactive, also proactive, and say, okay, well, these are the regions that we'd like to have more wind capacity in, and put that out there and let the wind farm developers react to that. So that's on the system planning side. The other part is short-term wind energy forecasting. So once you've made a decision of how much capacity you need in the province, you've got the wind farms that are operating, it has an impact on your daily dispatch. If the wind blows, you get energy, and like I said, this impacts different generators. For that, you need, as I mentioned, the meteorological forecast. The short-term forecasting and long-term forecasting are very different. I mean, nobody can forecast what the wind is going to be in 2020 at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday the 14th of August. So. But you have statistical descriptions of it. So for the long-term forecasting, you need to have statistical models. But some of the elements that you have for the statistical models, they carry over to the short-term forecast, in particular power curves. And I'll spend a whole slide on that. Let's get back to the forecasting itself. Now, I've seen some papers where people take historical wind energy data and use that to forecast. And in my view, that's it's not only extremely difficult, I think it's not as accurate as it should be. What this means is that you need a fundamental model. Basically, wind energy is nothing else but a wind turbine converts kinetic energy into electrical energy. So you need to model the wind speed and a converter that converts the wind speed into energy. And that's the fundamental model. Just to show you that modeling wind energy directly is not that easy, let's have a look at this actual energy output. This is the energy output of the entire province of Ontario over Q1 in 2010. Okay? Now, this doesn't look anything like that as regular. If you were to use this time series and build a statistical model to predict and forecast, if you're in, say, this region, if it's going down, you can do extremely well just by persistence forecasting. You take the last two values and you predict simple linear regression. You can do tremendously well here. The only thing is, at this point, then you're going to be really off because the wind is going to go up again. So if you have some error measure that sort of averages the error, on average you can actually do pretty well. But what you cannot catch is these turning points where the wind goes from really high to really low. And these are the points that put stress on the system. So if you think the wind energy is going to go up, say, 800, and your next forecast would be, say, 820, it doesn't happen, it actually is 780, then you need some backup generator to take care of those 40 megawatts. And if you have to do this instantaneously, it's going to be very, very expensive. So not being able to forecast these ups and downs accurately, these turning points, is very expensive to the system. So that's the wind power time series itself. even if you look at the distributional aspects of it, if you want to model this, if you model the energy output distribution, the distribution is different according to the time of year. If you look in the summer, this is the top. This is the energy distribution over the summer months. This is a very fast decaying exponential distribution, where most of the time you're not producing any energy at all. Like there's no wind or very little wind, and at the far end you're not producing 80 to 90% of your capacity a lot of the times. The total average capacity on this is about 11%. If you look in the winter months, there's times when you don't produce energy, but there's also a sufficient number of times where you produce your maximum amount of energy. This distribution is U-shaped. You can see the level is much higher than it is here. This has an average capacity factor of about 35%. So different seasons have different distributional characteristics, and there's no easy way of characterizing these and transition of going from one season to another. Okay, if you want to parameterize this, basically you can do it with an exponential, but this, I don't know what that would be. And if you want to have one family of distributions that capture this in its entirety, I haven't seen that. Okay. Well, actually not true. I've developed something, but it's horrendously complex. So these are the different distributions. So that basically tells you that modeling energy directly is an area where you don't want to go. Okay. So let's go back to the fundamental model. As I said, wind speed or wind energy is nothing else but a turbine converts kinetic energy into electricity. And it does that according to what is called a power curve. Okay. Now, I think most of you have taken physics classes. What's the energy in kinetic energy? It's a function of mass and velocity. It's a half times mv squared. Okay. So that's the energy that's in a body of air mass. This moves through a turbine at a speed of v. So the amount of energy moving through the turbine as a function of time is a half times m times v to the power q. So it's the relation between energy output and wind speed is cubic. And that explains the rise of this power curve. It goes really, really fast. If you look at, if you go down this power curve up to about 3 meters per second, you don't get any power. because these blades have inertia, so they need some minimal energy to spin. Then at 4 meters per second, then you start generating power. At 5, you've got about, I think it's about 8% output. If you double the wind speed, you go from 5 meters per second to 10, you go from 8 to 80% output. Okay? That's the nonlinear relationship. Okay? Then you go up the power curve. Then there's what is called the rated speed at 12 meters per second. That's the minimum speed where you have the maximum output. And that speed, that output, consists until about 25 meters per second for this particular turbine. And then beyond the 25 meters, the wind energy is too strong, the turbine cuts off. And this is another risk factor. This has happened in Germany. It's definitely happened in Texas on two or three occasions where there's really, really strong winds. You get about 12 to 1500 megawatts output. The winds were too strong, and all of a sudden, generators started cutting out, and they lost within 5 or 10 minutes. They lost about 600-700 megawatts of output. They were able to control that, but if it would have been more, it would have been a blackout or a brownout. Okay. Okay. So, if you want to model wind in a fundamental way, this is what you need to do. You need to have a power curve. There's two things I want to point out here. There's two gentlemen that have relevance to this graph. It's Albert Betz. He's a German engineer, and he figured out the amount of energy that you can extract from air mass. And there's a theoretical limit. It's 16/27, which is 59%. And he basically figured out that, and it's called Betz's law. So he controls where you are on the y-axis, and Weibull controls where you are on the x-axis. It turns out that if you look at historical wind speeds, you look at distribution of wind speeds, that a Weibull distribution is an extremely good approximation for that distribution. Weibull is governed by two different parameters. It provides a better fit than a normal or a log normal distribution. And it's now even so that a lot of the wind atlases, if you're a wind developer and you want to look at locations where you do put your wind farms, the energy content at certain locations is quoted in terms of the parameters of the Weibull distribution. Okay? That's why this is fairly important. Let me see, there's a nice anecdote on Weibull. The Weibull distribution is now in sort of entrenched in science. He submitted his paper in, I think, 1933 to a Swedish journal, and I got back with a comment saying this, we have no idea how this could be applied, and we reject your paper. We don't see any scientific value in this. So this is, I think, 33 or 34. He submitted it again, got another rejection, and finally he got it published in 1951. And it turned out this distribution has an application in like a lot of different areas, and it's now one of the standard distributions. So then, the American Association of Mechanical Engineers thought we must do something about this. They awarded him a gold medal, which he accepted, and I think he passed away 3 or 4 years after that, at the age of 80-something. So this is just to tell you that if you feel that your scientific work isn't appreciated, just wait. At some point, you'll be rewarded a medal. Okay. So this is the fundamental model, the power curve. Now, it would be very nice if every turbine had the same power curve, but they don't. So what you need is some nice way of characterizing this power curve in terms of the parametric family, which you can easily calibrate to the specifications of turbines that manufacturers have. We developed a very nice model, and we fitted it to about 7 or 8 different turbine types, and it gives a really, really good description. So this blue line, that's actually a fitted curve to these dots, and it's governed by two parameters, and it covers a lot of these turbine types. Okay, so the other thing that it does is a lot of people that use power curves, when you go to the manufacturer's power curve, they give you a discretized power curve. So they give you output at certain discrete points of wind speed. So what a lot of people do if they do simulations, they take this discretized version, fit some spline to this, and then simulate. And if you want to do a lot of simulations, this is an expensive process. So with a parametric curve, this is a lot faster. And the nice thing is that because this is monotonic, you've got a nice mathematical formula for it, you can actually invert this as well. And this is important. I'll come back to that at a later slide. So from this, we can go from wind speed to energy, but we can also back out from a certain energy what the implied wind speed is. And this is really, really easy to do, at least under this model. Okay. So then we have the different turbine types. This was in, I think about 3 or 4 years ago, we had five different turbine types within the province, all with slightly different characteristics and different power curves, different cut-in speeds, cut-out speeds, etc. And these are the wind farms where these turbines were located and the number of those turbines. Okay. As I mentioned, every single one of these turbines has a slightly different power curve. And although they may look very, very similar, because of this exponential rise, like a small difference in the curve makes a big difference in the output. Okay? So calibrating these curves is very, very important. Okay. So this sort of goes into building this fundamental model. So you have the power curve, you look at all the different wind farms or turbines are located where. You figure out what the from the manufacturer what the discrete power curve is, and you fit the model to this. That's one. That the power curve is different. No, the power curve that's sort of like a standard. Yeah. Yeah, that's actually why I'm happy that Bill is here. I think it is. I mean, I have not seen anything that sort of the power curve is slipping. And I think if it would, you notice this on the energy output, and because I mean, energy is money, so they would rectify it. Okay, so that's the fundamental model. Let me talk about the people that use these type of models and are interested in energy forecast. This is the ISO control room. Mm-hmm. It's in a secret location in Ontario somewhere. This is a critical part of Ontario's infrastructure. So if somebody blows this up, then the whole province is without electricity. so there's a nice sideline story here. I got invited to do a presentation to them on wind forecasting. So I took a taxi and said, okay, I want to go to this location. And the taxi driver looked on his GPS and said, there's nothing there. Yeah, trust me, there is. So he drove me to it, and there's like a big gate, and you have to go through it, and so a nondescript building. So what is this thing? I can't tell you. So he dropped me off, and he said, you work for the CIA? I said, so. But inside, it's pretty impressive. They got this massive hall with lots and lots of screens, basically picturing every single element of the electricity system, every junction, every transmission line, etc. Now, the job of the ISO, their work is to balance the system in real time. So you have load, you have generation, and this needs to be balanced. If demand and supply do not match exactly, you get, you have problems. So what they do is they continuously match demand and supply. That means that they're interested in the state of the system over the next 5 minutes, the next hour, maybe 2 or 3 hours, but not that much beyond. I mean, because they're really operational on a very, very short time frame. So they're interested in wind speed forecasts and wind energy forecasts on a very short time frame, 5 minutes to an hour, 3 hours. Okay? Now, if you're looking at that sort of time span, you could actually use wind energy because of the persistence. So if I want to predict what the wind energy in the next 5 minutes is, I can take the energy now and 5 minutes before and do a linear extrapolation. And I wouldn't be too far off. But if you do that beyond 3 or 4 hours, you're going to get big errors. But for 5 minute intervals balancing, that works. Okay, the other client for this type of work are generators. This is the control room of OPG. Well, this is one of our publicity pictures. We had, she actually does work there. We had some of our normal staffers who were actually in the picture, but the photographer said, well, we want to portray a nice, wholesome image of the company, so. And that's why they're not in this picture. Okay. Like, the job that people do in this control room, it's 24/7, they work 12-hour shifts. They basically submit bids and offers of their generation into the market. The structure of the market is such that anybody who has a market license, has a generator, is obliged to submit their capacity into the market. What price? That's a different matter. If you don't want to run, then you offer at a really high price, but you're there in case if there's an emergency. Okay? Like, bids need to be offered into the market 3 hours in advance. So at 12 o'clock, they submit bids, and that's for running at 3 o'clock. Within that 3 hour time frame, you cannot make any changes. You're locked in. So they're interested in forecasts of wind energy from 3 hours to a day ahead. No, it's basically everything has to be offered to the ISO.
Okay, with the
broker,
the unique broker.
Yeah. So there's one market mechanism. Yeah. Okay, so that's the other client. Now I'm going to talk a bit about. I'll give you a short course on electricity markets and pricing. Okay, that's the electricity 101. Okay. So I said, every generator has to bid its generation into the market. They don't have to bid everything in one go. So this would be a generator which has, it's a 100 megawatt unit. This could be like a small unit of a coal-fired station or a gas-fired station, whatever. Now, what this means is, okay, this is a price-quantity pair, PQ pair. At a price of 20 megawatts, they're willing to supply up to 10 megawatts. Okay. Then from up to 50 megawatts, so for the next 50 megawatts, they'll charge $30. Okay. Then for the next 20 megawatts on top of that, they charge 40, 60, and up to $100 for the last 10 megawatts. Now, they price this such that this reflects startup costs. And there's some region here where the fuel is being utilized most efficiently. Now, if the market wants more energy, it means that the fuel efficiency isn't there, and therefore that you need to charge a higher price. So at the far end, they'll charge $100. Okay? So every single generator submits a price-quantity pair. I think Ontario Power Generation submits, I think, a couple of thousand of these PQ pairs every single hour. So this goes into a stack with everything else that every other generator is supplying. And then basically what the ISO is doing is they look at, they have a certain demand to fulfill. They look at the cheapest generation first, take that, then go to the next cheapest one, etc., etc. So all these price quantity pairs are ranked according to price. So up to $5,000, you would have a price of just above $0. And then you can see up here, this curve starts rising fairly steep. Okay. Now suppose that the system load is 17,000 megawatts. So then basically what the ISO does is it walks up the stack. 17,000, this is where the marginal cost is. That is a cost of $29. Okay. So this unit is being dispatched up to 10 megawatts. Everybody who bids in lower than $29 runs. Everybody above the $29 does not run. So if your price offer is $29.01, you don't run. If it's $28.99, you run. Everybody who runs gets the market price. So even if you bid in at, say, $1, If the market clearing price is 29, you get $29. Okay, so that's how that works. Yes? That's the market mechanism that we have, that most electricity markets have. It basically forces you, most generators, to offer at a marginal cost. Because basically, if you want to run, the lower you bid in, and still make a profit, that's your marginal cost. And that ensures that the cheapest production is being run and best for the whole market. Okay? That's basically a mechanism to ensure that you get marginal cost as an outcome. Okay. Okay, so if the demand is, say, about 20,500, market price, clearing price would be 45. This means that this unit is this lamination is dispatched, this 10 megawatts run, this 50 runs, and these 20, so it's running up to 80 megawatts. Okay. Then if there's some spike in demand, 24,000 megawatts, the clearing price is $120, this whole unit would be dispatched. Okay. So, okay, this is the world before wind was a big issue. Okay. Now, there's two issues here that I should point out. Okay, you've got this region here, which is coal. These prices don't differ that much. It's a fairly broad range. So if the demand changes a little bit, it doesn't have that much impact on price. And with coal being phased out, so this whole part is disappearing, means that this part, this higher part, is going to be at this end. Okay? But what saved us over the last year and a half or so is the discovery of shale gas. Shale and gas prices have been fairly low, but if that wouldn't have happened, then this high stack would have been around here. It would have seen much higher electricity prices. What it does is, if this part disappears, so you get this high stack going up here, it means that a little change in demand has a big impact on price, increases price volatility. Okay, so that's something which, yeah, that's the reality we live in. It's not nice, but that's okay. If that was the only thing that happened, then we could live with it. Now, this is where wind comes in. Okay. Wind is must run, which means that it is dispatched first, and it's basically inserted at the beginning of the stack. Okay. So if you have zero wind, then you have this stack. If you have 1,000 megawatts of wind, this entire stack is shifted by 1,000. No, whatever shows up is taken. And this, again, this wouldn't be too bad if you could predict accurately that there's going to be 1,000 megawatts of wind. Okay, suppose that you're in this region. Say demand goes up by, say, just 200 megawatts. Then you go from a price of just below 50 to almost $70 or $80. Okay. And what wind is doing is it inserts this part here. That means the stack is shifting back and forth, and that means that the clearing price is going to be fairly uncertain. Okay. And not just the clearing price, but also what is going to be dispatched and what not. Okay. Now, if you get a lot of wind, then okay, this is called base load. This is base load hydro. Like you basically, it's run out of the river. And the Ed and Beck, which runs in Niagara. If you don't utilize the water, then it's lost energy. So they basically bid in very low to make sure they run. But if you have wind running at the beginning, if you insert, say, 10,000 megawatts of wind, then this point, this may actually be beyond the clearing price. So that means that some of our very cheap hydro does not run. And you could even have a situation where it could cut into the nuclear generation. And the nuclear bids in at very low prices or even negative prices because it's very expensive to, you can shut them down, but if they're shut down, you have to shut them down for a day or 2 days. Yeah, well, basically, no, I mean, if you take out coal, this part shifts to the left.
Okay, so if you put wind
in, then everything shifts to the right. Yeah.
Okay. Coal is not disappearing.
No, I mean, coal is disappearing. So you have two effects. One is that coal is disappearing, and you have the impact of wind and everything. So it's the worst of two worlds. Okay, so this is how wind impacts price and dispatch of generators. Okay. So I got to be careful here because Bill works for Siemens, who sells wind turbines. So. Okay. Yeah. So you're. Either way, either at this end of the stack or that end of the stack. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Okay. No. No. Wind goes first.
Why?
Well, that's the way the market is set up. Wind goes before everything. That's the way it is. So. Okay, it's a good question, but okay. So that's the impact of a wind. That's why we want to know how much wind there is. Yes. No, the wind comes first. No, they don't have to bid in a price. That's the FIT contract. They supply all the wind. They have a fixed price contract, regardless of the market price. Everybody else is subjected to the market price. No. No. Well, this is, like, a lot of jurisdictions are now looking at, this is doing bad things to the system, so maybe we should do something about it, but currently in Ontario, it's still this. Wind runs, and they get paid a fixed price, and displaces everything else. Okay. Let me give you an example. This is April 27th this year. So this is the actual wind power. And what happened is, this is in the evening, I think about 9, 10 o'clock. At this point, the exports are ramping up, so we're exporting power out of the province. The gas generators are ramping down, because most of the early evening load had disappeared. And all of a sudden, wind dropped from this to this. This is wind power output, dropped over 1 hour period on average of 400 megawatts. So that's an average drop over an hour of 400. But if you look at, say, 5 minute intervals, you have a bigger drop there. Now, what that meant is the system wasn't expecting this. So all of a sudden, you need to put generators online to make up for the deficit. It's a 5 minute market. The ISO balances the system every 5 minutes. You have a 5 minute clearing price. The hourly clearing price is the average of the 12 5-minute. The first 5 minute interval of this hour was $2,000, the maximum price that can be. And then it went quickly back down to normal prices. But just because of this unexpected drop in wind, it caused much more expensive generators to be dispatched. So what happened here is you had to be up here in the stack to have very flexible generation, which is priced very expensively. Okay. And this blip only lasted for about 5-10 minutes, but I mean, if I get paid $2,000 in 5 minutes, I mean, I don't mind it lasting only 2 or 3 intervals. Okay, so okay, let's go to the forecasting. So how do we do forecasting? Okay. It's something wonderful called NOAA. It's the North American Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. And they provide free forecasts of anything meteorological you can think about. There's a grid, meteorological grid, that spans the entire globe. It's in resolution of a half degrees latitude and longitude, and all meteorological data You can download on a grid basis. If you want to know what the forecasted wind speed is, the forecasted temperature, humidity, sunshine, you name it. These are massive files, and let's say they're freely available. Now, what they offer is 60 observations at 3-hour time intervals. This goes out 180 hours in advance, and that gives you the forecast for wind speed. That's what we're interested in. This is updated every 6 hours at Greenwich Mean Time. This is 0 Zulu time, 6, 12, and 18 Zulu time. So every 6 hours you can download new updates on this. Like I said, the forecasts are free, and what it gives you is wind speeds and direction at various pressure levels. So they have 1,000 millibar level, 900, etc., etc. Yeah. Well, sort of. You know, if you got a lower barometric pressure, it must be higher, but you have no idea what a certain barometric pressure level, what height that corresponds to. So we're interested here. Most turbines have a height, the hub height is 50 or 80 meters. You really like a forecast at 50 or 80 meters. So somehow we need to transform all these forecasts at pressure levels into an altitude level. Okay. Okay, this is like how we implemented this. Basically, what we do is we download the wind speeds at all the different pressure levels. There's about, I think, 10 or 12 of them. We then, out of that, we compute some proxy for wind speed at a certain altitude. We convert those wind speeds to energy using a power curve. And then what I then do is, I look back in history, say over the last 24 hours, and I know the exact power that was produced during those hours. Now, what I can then do with the power curve, and this is where it comes in really handy that this thing is invertible, I can then look at the actual wind energy. From that, I can then impute an implied wind speed, and I can use that to recalibrate my forecasted wind speeds. Then I have my recalibrated wind speeds, and I feed those to the power curve. And this works actually fairly well. So the whole thing is we get the velocities at different pressure levels from the global forecasting system. These gives us, you put them through a power curve, that gives you raw megawatts. I compare them to the actual megawatts over the last historical period, last 24 hours or 12 hours, whatever I choose. From that, I back out with through the power curve, what the implied wind speed is. Then I look at my implied wind speeds and my model wind speeds. I do some adjustment and feed that back through the power curve, and I get my adjusted megawatts. Okay? And this actually works fairly well. Now, actually, don't take my word for it. You'll see some graphs. And good question. Yep. You'll actually see at some of the forecasts the I need to do some interpolation to get the 3 hours into hourly data. And I mean, that's a very good point. What you see in the forecast is my forecasts are much smoother than reality. And this is because I have 3 hour intervals, interpolate into a 1 hour level. And of course, you lose variability doing that. Okay. Okay, let me give you one forecast. Okay. So the blue is the forecast. And the red is the actual. Okay. Now, would you say this is a good forecast?
Up to a point.
Up to a point. Okay. Well, okay. Let me clarify that point. Okay. If I take standard error measures, okay, I take this, and I do say an L1 or L2 difference. This is a really bad forecast because I'm off by about 400 or 500 megawatts. Okay. But what this is showing me is, if I look, remember, if we go back to, like, we have, like, generators need to dispatch the units. They need to look in advance at what's going to happen. So this tells you, the forecast tells you that wind energy is going to go up. It's going to plateau, then going to go up again, and then sort of go down again. So this gives you an advance warning, like 2, 3, 4 hours in advance, of what you should do with your generators. So if this is a forecast that we made, say, 12 hours before, Like you get close, we have updates every 6 hours, and then the next time you get a better forecast for the short term. Now, what this is telling you is that there's a discrepancy, but this represents a weather front that came in about 2 or 3 hours sooner than we predicted. So all you need to do is visually shift this curve, and you get a very good forecast. Yes? So this is a forecast at one particular point in time. I'll go to that in one of my next slides. You can actually see the progression of forecasts to see how well a forecast behaves. Using standard error measures, this is not a very good forecast. But if you look at the underlying physics, like a weather front came in sooner or later, you can make the visual adaptations and get a pretty good forecast out of it. Okay. Second thing that's important for wind speed forecasts is, or wind energy forecasts. Think again of the power curve. Okay. If your wind speed is about 2 to 3, 4 meters per second, if you make an error of 1 meter per second, it doesn't matter because the output is zero. Okay. If you're at this range, if you predict 20, 22, or 18, it doesn't matter. You have full output. What does matter is in the middle. Okay? So the uncertainty, like this is almost exactly in the middle of the power curve. You've got a nice symmetric distribution, but this distribution changes according to where you are on the power curve. Let me show you that in an animation. Okay. Well, watch as this. What I've done here is I've taken a wind speed, I put a symmetric distribution around it with some deviation of, I think, 1 meter per second or something like that, and watch what the resulting energy distribution does as a function of where the wind speed is. Okay. So here's right skewed, the right fat tail. It goes towards the symmetric distribution. And the further along it moves, you see that the shape changes and the uncertainty changes. Okay. If you look at, so it means that the uncertainty in your forecast is a function of where you are on the power curve. Okay. And this is important. If you look at your forecast, okay, let's look at this forecast. Okay. If you do the standard error measure again, I mean, this is a fairly large error. But this just means that the weather front came in about an hour or 2 hours earlier. Okay? So for planning purposes, this is a very good forecast. Now, if you look at this part here, you can see that the forecast underestimates the actual, but this is because you're at the bottom of the power curve. That means 1 meter per second difference in your forecast makes a big difference in your energy output. So this you can explain. But you can see that the forecast is actually capturing the shape, and for planning purposes, being able to decide what units to put on at certain times, this is pretty good. Okay. So I mean, this just goes to show that numerical accuracy is not always the end all. Okay, now let me show you where these forecasts are being used. Okay, I've got about two more slides to go. This is a forecast that was made in March 2010. So this is the forecast. So so if you're in the control room, you want to look at what's going to happen with your event forecast. You're going to see that on Thursday, sorry, this is your forecast. Yeah. So you get the forecast, say, Tuesday or Wednesday. It's telling you that day ahead, the wind is going to go down. It's going to go up again. It's going to reach some medium level here. It's going to go down, then go up again, etc. So if you're in the control room and deciding what to dispatch over the next couple of hours, this is really important for you. But this means that wind energy is going to go down. This is the early morning hours when load is ramping up. So you need more power, but wind is going to go down. So that means there's upward pressure on price. Then if you look at, say, Friday, Saturday, this tells you that there's going to be a fair amount of wind over the weekend. And going for, say, Saturday, Sunday, this is important for trading. This tells you that you've got about 1,100 megawatts of wind on the system, and this is when trading decides what to sell forward. So on, say, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we get called, they get calls from Hydro-Quebec, do you want to sell us power? And this tells them that it's going to be a lot of power, so maybe we should sell. If there wasn't any power, then they wouldn't sell. So if you look what actually happened, so this is what actually happened. You see this drop happened, not to the exact level that was forecasted, but the drop happened. And the recovery happened, goes up, goes down, goes up again, high level, and then it trails off during the rest of the week. So in terms of like numerical accuracy, I mean, whatever measure you take, you can make it as bad as you want. But in terms of running the system, running your units, this is a pretty good forecast. Okay, then this is a year ago. And just to show you that the system hasn't lost its touch. There's a forecast of last Tuesday. Wednesday going forward. So you can see we actually learned running the system. So this is capturing almost exactly the shape. And look at this. This is a forecast made on Wednesday for Sunday and Monday, so 5 or 6 days ahead. Okay. I've got to be honest that this is one of the better forecasts. It doesn't always happen, but I mean, even if you're right 3 out of 5 times, that's a pretty good batting average. And I've noticed that different times of year, there's different quality of forecasts. And if I take my forecast, say, at 6 in the morning or 12 in the morning, there's different quality of forecasts. Because the global forecasting system takes data from all over the world. And some stations only submit, say, once a day, others on irregular frequencies. So if you capture that particular hour where everybody submits their info, those forecasts are much more accurate. Okay. And nobody tells you this. So that's the installed capacity, 1,400. So this is not a constant line because some units are like they're being. Okay. Then my final conclusion. Okay. So basically, the raw wind speeds give a very. The raw forecast give a very good pattern, indication of the shape and pattern of wind energy. It provides an early indication of ramp events and periods of high and low energy. This is what you want to forecast because that involves price changes. This is when you want to be in the market or not in the market. What you do need, however, is some local information to scale the forecast to improve the megawatt accuracy of your forecast. And this is what I've done by using like your last 12-hour history and then recalibrating the model. This works very nicely. And like I said, the one thing that made this successful is that a lot of time was spent in explaining the models to the users, explaining the power curve, where uncertainties happen, and that if there's a bad forecast, that you should look at the shape and shift it visually. And now they're okay with this, and they actually can use this, and they're very happy with it. And if the forecast isn't produced, then some angry calls are being made. So this is all that I wanted to say. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you very much.
Okay. It's easier to get hold of. Yes. Well, I've looked at Environment Canada. One thing that I'd like to do is to capture some of the uncertainty around the forecast is ensemble forecasting. I mean, they're doing this, but it's getting there is not that easy. Uh, 25 years.